Good evening, and welcome to all who are here, especially if you are visiting with us. Again, we're grateful that you have come for the purpose of worshiping God, and may He be glorified in all that we do. As has been mentioned, both in the songs and the prayers that we have given to Him thus far. Tonight, I want to continue my study in the book of Psalms. We're going to be dealing this evening with the 64th Psalm, another Psalm of David. And this is another Psalm that deals with some themes that are familiar from David's standpoint. But yet, as I pointed out, even though many of the topics we're going to be dealing with here are, some of them I describe as typical Davidic, others I just point to the fact that he's dealt with some of them before, but there's always little tidbits. If you take the time to look at the specific phrases where you can learn something different from what David says from one psalm to another in many instances. And there's lessons for us to learn in that. Sometimes when we utter prayers to God, we say the same thing over and over, and there's nothing wrong with that. Repetition is not condemned in Scripture. Vain repetition is condemned in Scripture. And my point is sometimes just mix up the words a little bit and rephrase what you're saying. You say the same thing, but it keeps it fresh in your mind and keeps you from doing that. And we find a lot of that with David as he words many of his psalms to God as he is praising Him. This particular psalm is one that I have entitled Secret Plots. Secret plottings, because that's what we find that he is dealing with. He's dealing with enemies who are plotting things against him. Like almost every psalm that we've studied of David, it is ascribed to the chief musician. In addition to that, it is described as a Psalm of David, and that's the only things that we are actually told about this particular psalm. However, it is interesting to note that the occasion when you read this psalm could apply to a number of different times in the life of David. We're not given the specifics of the time, and many are hesitant to put a specific time. As a matter of fact, there are some who look at events that happen after the life of David that are even more applicable to the things that are said in this particular psalm, and I'm going to bring some of those up as we go through this psalm. However, it seems to fit the same time frame of many of the psalms that we have addressed of late. And that is dealing with the latter part of David's life, the latter part of David's reign, when his son Absalom stages a rebellion against him, as recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 15 and following. We find that one of the ways that Absalom turned the people against David is he stood outside of his palace where people were approaching for judgment, and he basically criticized the government. He said they're slow in taking care of business, and you know what? I'll take care of it. And if I were king, this is what I would do. Kind of sounds like the political television ads that we get where all of these candidates are going to solve all the problems in the world. We know better. It's empty words is exactly what it is, and a lot of times it's associated with secret plotting. You do what you have to do to win, and if it means you destroy your enemy in the process, that's what you do. And I mention that not to bring up politics. I mention that because that's what happens in this psalm. That's what Absalom did to David, and there's many other examples of it in Scriptures. So, with that in mind, we want to look at this particular psalm. So let's go ahead and read the 64th Psalm. It is a relatively short psalm, only 10 verses. Begins with, "Hear my voice, O God, in my meditation. Preserve my life from fear of the enemy. Hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the rebellion of the workers of iniquity, who sharpen their tongue like a sword, and bend their bows to shoot their arrows. bitter words, that they may shoot in secret at the blameless, suddenly that shoot at him and do not fear. They encourage themselves in an evil matter. They talk of laying snares secretly. They say, who will see them? They devise iniquities. We have perfected a shrewd scheme. Both the inward thought and the heart of man are deep. But God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Suddenly they shall be wounded. So he will make them stumble over their own tongue. All who see them shall flee away. All men shall fear and shall declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider his doing. The righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him, and all the upright in heart shall glory. And thus we see another Psalm of David. And the way this psalm begins is what I describe as typical Davidic form. That is very typical of David. How does he begin so many of his psalms? With a prayer. Or mentioning that this is a prayer to God. Hear my voice, O God of my meditation. So often that's how he begins. He approaches God. And you understand that he is making a request of God. And we certainly don't need to be repetitious as to pointing out the importance of prayer and that lesson that we learn from him. The word meditation, as is used in the New King James Version, is in the New American Standard, it's the word complaint. In the King James Version, it's the word prayer. Hear my prayer, hear my meditation, hear my complaint. And so he's pleading with God for some help. That's what we begin with there. Now the next statement that he makes here is he says here in verse 1, preserve my life from the fear of the enemy. Now again, we've talked about his life being preserved in about half the Psalms that David does. He talks about that and he pleads with God to preserve him. But I want you to notice there's something different about what he says here. Notice what he asks to be preserved from. The fear of the enemy. Another way of saying that is David is making a request of God that he not be afraid of his enemies. Have you ever thought about how fear sometimes defeats? How often is it that when we become afraid of whatever it is, it defeats us before we ever start? It keeps us from trying to fight back. It keeps us from doing anything whatsoever. Well, here David is saying, as I understand this, he's saying, make me so that I am not afraid of my enemy. And of course, he's not talking about being foolhardy in that. He's not talking about not being cautious, but he's talking about, don't make me give up. Don't make me do something that I will regret because I am afraid of them. You know, when we study scriptures, we find that God has very little respect for the cowardly. For those who will not stand up for that which is right. In Revelation 21 and in verse number 8, you find there a list. You find there a list of those who will not inherit the kingdom of God. And at the very beginning of that list is the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. He begins with the cowardly. Those who won't stand up for that which is right. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, we find that Peter there says, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled, but sanctify the Lord God in your heart. And be ready always to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Now we often quote verse 15 there, don't we? Sanctify God in your heart and be ready to defend what you believe. But what did he say in the verse prior to that? He quotes from the Old Testament. He quotes there from Isaiah 8 and verse 12. Do not be afraid of their threats. Do not be troubled. Don't let them keep you from doing what you need to do. And one of the points that we need to give consideration to where our enemy is concerned is we don't need to let them shake us to the point where we cower and don't do what we need to do. How often is it we won't tell somebody about the gospel because we're afraid of the consequence of what might happen? Not what will happen, and usually it doesn't. Even though there are some circumstances where you know because of the background of the individual you're dealing with, and I'll tell you where this applies more often than not, it's when you're dealing with erring brethren. When you're dealing with a brother who has a stubborn disposition, when you're dealing with a brother who is rebellious in their attitude, you have a pretty good idea of what they're going to be like when you confront those individuals. But you know what? Does that give you an excuse not to confront them? No, it does not. You still have the responsibility to face your, in that case, and I hesitate to call that your enemy, but your erring brother in a hostile environment, and that might be the way to describe that situation. You still have a responsibility to not fear and stand up for what is right. Pray to God for strength in doing that. That is what David begins this prayer, this psalm, with as he approaches his God. But he goes on, and after he says that, in the very next verse he says, "Hide from me the secret plots of the wicked." And I'll tell you what I see in that particular expression. When he says, "Hide from me their secret plots," I see the point that David is requesting that God will help them see what they're trying to do and make him aware of the things that they're doing and protect him so that he's not caught by their wicked devices, whatever those are. And I want to continue the thought that I mentioned a minute ago about not being afraid of your enemies. At the same time, you need to be cautious. Just because you're not afraid of your enemy doesn't mean that you storm in there, as they say, with guns blazing and with no protection. You need to do everything you can to protect yourself. You need to act with caution. You need to act with soberness. You need to act with alertness as you deal with your enemies. Because your goal is to win whatever the battle is. So you don't fear to the point that you surrender or run away, but at the same time, for lack of a better term, you respect your enemy. You realize the capability of your enemy, and you don't underestimate that capability. I'm reminded of 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 11, where Paul's talking about the enemy of all of us. He's talking about the devil taking advantage of us. And he says there, we are not ignorant of his devices. Don't be ignorant of the devices of Satan ever. Satan's your worst enemy. And I tell you right now, when you have an enemy, you need caution and you need soberness and alertness in dealing with them. And so David makes that request of him. Basically, he's saying, deliver me from their plottings, which means he wants to be alert where those things are concerned. And along with that, you know, he talks about their secret plotting, which is the idea of scheming, the idea of their devising things secretly, they're devising things behind his back. Well, I'll have more to say about that because he deals with that all throughout this psalm. But he also adds to that rebellion. These are individuals who are rebellious. As a matter of fact, he says there, the rebellion of the workers of iniquity there in verse number 2. I'll tell you right now, this fits Absalom perfectly. Because that is exactly what Absalom did where David was concerned. Now, I know it also applied to Saul early in his life, King Saul. And then there's other occasions in his life where he had enemies who did the same thing. But this just so fits in that category where you are dealing with the rebellion of Absalom against him. And quite often, that's the attitude that you have to deal with. And I want you to know in this, that if this is Absalom, well, if it's David, or if it's King Saul, who is the enemy as this happens, David's innocent. at least innocent from the standpoint of he hasn't provoked his enemy to do this against him. I realize that Absalom's rebellion is actually a punishment. It's a part of his punishment because of his sin with Bathsheba. But he didn't specifically provoke this. He wasn't specifically doing something evil to turn Absalom against him. The same thing was true with David, or with King Saul. We know that David was totally innocent in that instance. Quite often, rebellion takes place against those who are standing for that which is right. And that's another reason why we need to be ever so alert in dealing with him. Well, now he goes on, and in the next verse, he talks about how they sharpen their tongue like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, bitter words. He mentions the bow, he mentions the sword, both weapons of war that were used back then. And of course, what he's talking about in this case is he's not talking about the physical weapons, at least not at first. Even though his enemies had bows and swords, and they tried to use them against him, but what they start with is words. I'm going to tell you right now, just about every war begins with words. And it usually begins with bitter words, plottings. That's how divisions take place so often. We are once again, as we look at this, reminded of the power of the tongue. Words can do such great harm, and sometimes they are all that is needed to destroy something. I do not need to remind you that churches have been divided, trust has been lost, problems have been caused or increased, Christians have been persecuted because of words, because of something that somebody says. And that's usually where the harm starts. Words usually come before fists start swinging. I'm an umpire. Most of you know that I umpire some sports here and there. I do basketball, football, and baseball. And in all three of those, I can tell you the problems that I've had always start with somebody saying something they shouldn't say. And after they say something, that's when the fist starts flying. And that's why you're taught to deal with it early. And you stop it before it happens. And that's just one example in life. If you're at work, you know what I'm talking about. In a family, whenever there's disagreement, doesn't it usually start with somebody saying something? Or doesn't that blow it up? So we know the dangers of words, and especially bitter words. Words that are pronounced with a tongue of anger. You find outside of Christ, nations have divided, wars have started, homes have been destroyed, friendships have been wiped out. The great misery has taken place. Bitter words have cost time and resources and countless other evils in society. In work, where things have to be cleaned up. So we need to guard against bitter words. That's the first weapon the enemy uses. Just this past week, the news reported a young lady who committed suicide because she was bullied. Again, and we know this is not the first time that we've heard this. And you have a group of, 8 or 9 teenagers that were arrested because they bullied this girl. I have no sympathy for them. I know that sounds harsh. I have no sympathy for people that do that because people need to think about the consequence of the words that they use. Words can ruin lives, and sometimes that's all that's needed. And that's what's happening that starts to turn the people against David on this occasion. And when you look in the Scriptures, as I said, there's multitudes of examples. You don't just have to think about Absalom. You remember the account of Mordecai and Haman? That's in the book of Esther. Mordecai was the uncle, I believe it was the uncle of Esther. Haman was the enemy. Haman hated Mordecai because Mordecai was good. And he tried to turn the king against him with bitter words. Same thing was true with Daniel and his enemies when you look at the book of Daniel. Bitter words, because Daniel made them look bad because what he did was right. You ever see that in the workplace? The one that has the good work ethics that makes everybody look bad? He's the one that his co-workers try to destroy. And then, of course, the greatest example of that is Jesus Christ Himself. They set out to destroy Jesus. They used bitter words against Him. They tried to find accusations with the thing that He said. And as they turned the people against Him with their words. In Proverbs chapter 30 and verse 14, you read, "There is a generation whose teeth are like swords and whose fangs are like knives to devour the poor off the earth and the needy from among them." Bitter words. Let's seek to avoid those. Going back to our text, that is what David approaches the Lord in dealing with and describing his enemy, what they are doing. And he points one out in verse number 4 that they shoot in secret at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him and they do not fear. May we never ever forget the dangers associated with the tongue. And that's exactly what you find them doing here. He says, and he points out there that they're shooting it at the blameless there in verse 4. And another thing that I find interesting here is it says they do not fear. Now, an interesting observation to make in talking about them not fearing is this is the second time in this psalm that the word fear is used. The word fear is actually used 3 times. We found it first in verse number 1 where David says, "Help me to not fear my enemies." Here you find the enemies do not fear God. They do not, they're not fearful of the consequences of the actions that they are engaged in, even though those actions are evil. Do we see that in society? Do we see people who act without a proper and a healthy fear? That's the attitude that these individuals have as they act. And the point that is being made there is this is an enemy that is brazen. This is an enemy that is totally confident and arrogant in his attitude. And because they're acting without they don't think there are consequences where their evil is concerned. Friend, let me tell you something. There is no bigger error than one can commit in this life than to fail to adequately fear God. And that's what these people were not doing. They were not showing reverence for God. In Matthew 10 and verse 28, Jesus said, "Do not fear him who can kill the body, who kills the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell." That's the one we need to be fearful of. That's the one we need to be concerned about. And that's why we need to serve God with fear. And that's why we study about God. That's why we need to learn how seriously we need to treat Him. And you want to know why I harp on reverence and worship? You want to know why I spent so much time bad-mouthing these soft-soaping community religions that we have now? It's not just because it's fun to bash everybody else. It's because the danger that they're approaching by casualizing worship, they're taking away reverence for God. That's exactly what they're doing. They're cheapening respect where God is concerned. And what that means is they don't fear God the way that they ought to. They don't see God as someone who they're going to have to stand before one day and He could cast their soul into hell if they don't live a godly life. We need to be reminded of that. Religion's not smooth things. A pure and undefiled religion is a religion that's going to let you know that you have to stay on the straight and narrow path to heaven that's difficult to follow after. Well, you find these individuals here, there is no fear of God. And they're arrogant. they go on and they encourage themselves. He says in verse number 5, they encourage themselves in an evil matter. They talk of laying snares secretly. They say, who will see them? They devise iniquities. We have perfected a shrewd scheme, they say there. I want you to notice they encourage themselves. They think that they're doing what's right. They have deceived themselves. And quite often that's what the enemy does. He lies to himself about this is a good thing. And of course he's looking at good from his definition of good. Or he's looking at good from what he gets out of it. He's looking at the ultimate end where he is concerned. You know what I'm reminded of there is, you remember when Jesus, and I didn't write this verse down, but in the book of John, toward the end of his life, in about chapter 11, after he raises Lazarus from the dead, they're sitting there conspiring with each other, and basically the council decides, you know what, it's expedient that one man die rather than the nation perish. They were lying to themselves, thinking that they were doing the right thing by murdering an innocent man because he exposed their wickedness. Well, that's the attitude that you have in these individuals here, encouraging themselves in evil matters, in all things that they do. How many today act against the ungodly with total delusion? And it applies to our worldly enemies who want to destroy the Christian faith. And even among brethren, it applies to those who seek to portray themselves in the best light while portraying the brother who opposes them and whatever the problem as the most wicked person in the world. I'm the good guy. He's the bad guy. You ever see that? You know, in dealing with problems, you know, this can't we all just get along that I'm preaching on throughout time now? And we're going to deal with attitudes? You can't have that attitude if you want to solve a problem. You got to honestly look at yourself first. All of us have to do that. But so many people, when it comes to differences between brethren, it's all their fault and we paint them as the worst possible person in the world, and I'm innocent. I haven't done anything wrong whatsoever. And usually, neither one of those sides is right. Now, there are times when you are totally innocent. In which case, your enemy is guilty of both sides of this. He's painting the worst picture and he's made you out to be something that you're not, while making himself out to be innocent. And you see all kinds of sin in that, don't you? So that's the attitude that these people have. And that's how you live with yourself when you're devising evil schemes. That's just the truth of it. You learn to lie to yourself. You learn to delude yourself. And what a dangerous attitude that is for one to have. Now, the next thing they do is they set traps. They set traps. You go back into our text here. He goes on and he points out the fact that they lay snares secretly, saying, who will see them? Traps. And that's usually what the enemy does. They find some way to trick you, to bring you down. What did the enemies of Daniel do against him? Remember, the only way that they could trap Daniel was to convince the king to change the law, because they knew of the integrity that Daniel had. Wouldn't it be great if that applied to us? How many of us can live that pure of a life? I hope we do. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I look at my life. I see some major flaws there. You know, I think my enemy could dig and he could get me in trouble without having to trap me. Things I need to work on. But Daniel was upright and innocent. Nothing wrong with him. So they set a trap against him. What about Jesus? How often did the enemies of Jesus try to seek some way that they could accuse him, trap him in his words? That's what they try to do. You know, on those occasions when you read later on in the book of Luke, and it's in chapters 19 and 20, where the parade of Jews comes out against them, the Pharisees, the Sadducees,
whoever else, and they ask him all these fancy questions. You know, we got him now. You know, whose wife when whose wife will a man be when she has seven husbands and they all die and she doesn't have a child? We got him. Oh no, you didn't. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? And Jesus gives an answer that totally defeats them. But they're trying to trap him. They're trying to find something of which to accuse him. It backfired with Jesus, and I tell you right now that if we don't pay attention to what I said in the first part of this lesson, it'll backfire against us too. You know, the fact that you fear, but you also are cautious. So you find that happened with David. And these enemies, that's what they're doing, is they're setting these traps to try and attack their enemies. Now the traps they set, they think are foolproof. They say, who's going to see these things? Who's going to see what happens? Who's going to know that we've really devised an evil scheme? Have you ever thought that you covered every single angel on something? Or angel? You ever thought that you covered every single angle on some situation? You know, you sit there and you try to troubleshoot ahead of time, or you've got plans and you try to think about every possible thing that can go wrong, and you plan for all those things, and what goes wrong? It's the one thing you didn't think about, right? We call that the blind side. Blindsiding. And that's what it means. You're hit from an area that you don't expect it. Well, that's what these enemies are doing. They're setting traps, and they're so arrogant that they think there's no way in the world that we can get caught. I wonder if Babylon would like to have taken that back in the year 536. The night that they fell as a city. And so many other cities in history that you read about. Well, here's the trap set with these people that just think that it's all foolproof. And they're arrogant. And in all of this, there's a lesson in humility. The other point that I want to make before I move on here is he uses the word they all throughout these verses. They are the ones in verse number 6 who say, we have perfected a shrewd scheme. Both the inward thought and the heart of the man are deep. Now, when he talks about the they there, I want you to know that they're working together, and quite often enemies band together. They will band together against something. And that's something we have to be concerned about as Christians in this life. Is we may have two groups that are normally enemies against one another, but with a common cause they may come together against the godly so that they can destroy them. Well, that's what's happening here with David. This group together is banding against him. And then when he makes that expression there in the latter part of verse 6, both the inward thought and the heart of men are deep, that describes the depth to which they think that what they're doing is going to work. And it describes how deep down they are corrupt in their thinking. So there's the enemy. Now, what does David always do in his Psalms, though, after he talks about the enemy? He always talks about God being in control. And in verses 7 through 10, that is exactly what we find. You find in verse number 7, it says, God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Suddenly they shall be wounded. So he will make them stumble over their own tongue. All who set them shall flee away. Now this is an interesting point. You know, David talks about how they shoot the arrows of their tongue bitter words. They sharpen their sword and all those things. And then they start throwing them. And they have to keep throwing them to eventually hit you, right? That's the hope. Let me tell you something about God. He doesn't miss. God never misses. And you can look at example after example in Scripture. David, as he faced the giant Goliath, the Philistine, one stone between the eyes is all it took to bring that giant down. I know he got five of them out of the brook. That was four more than he needed. God never misses.
Absalom while he was pursuing David, trying to find David because he wanted to kill David after he evoked this rebellion. He's been found and he's fleeing away from David's army and he's on the run and his hair gets caught in a thorn bush or in a thicket. And he's sitting there hanging by his hair and Joab goes and kills him. He got caught. God doesn't miss. The best example of that is 1 Kings 22. That's King Ahab who is known for his wickedness. You may recall that he goes to war and he convinces the king of Judah to go with him. And as they're fighting against the enemy there, we find that Ahab disguises himself. And he has on armor, and he even has the king from the north, from Judah, dressed as he was. And when they find the king from the north and see that he's not Ahab, they let him go. You know how Ahab dies in that battle? It describes there in 1 Kings 22 that a bowman took his bow and he just shot up in the air, and a bow caught Ahab between the seam of his armor. And he bled to death in his chariot. Friends, God doesn't miss. I'd rather have him on my side than surrender to my enemies. And that's the request of David. And that's why Paul could say, "What can man do to me? If God be for us, who can be against us?" Romans 8, verse 31. Learn that lesson when you give confidence and when you think about God. And he says they're going to be caught with their own words. How often does that happen? Words used against somebody backfire because they are filled with lies. And I think of the words that Haman used. You know, when he convinced the king, he goes to build this gallows. And guess who gets hung on the gallows? It wasn't Mordecai. It was Haman. It was Haman who got caught with his own words. Quite often, that's what happens. And I'll tell you right now, that's why you need to always tell the truth. That's why you need to always be honest. Because when you lie, your sins will find you out. And eventually, if you live with enough lies, you're going to eventually get exposed. You're going to get caught. And you're going to get caught in your words. And I don't care how careful and how good you are at lying, and there's some good liars out there. You're going to get caught. Pray to God that it happens before it's too late, if that's who you are. Well, here, he points out that God will catch them. They'll be trapped with their own words. Kind of like David in 2 Samuel, you know, when he commits adultery with Bathsheba and the person guilty shall die, and the fingers pointed by Nathan, "You are the man." And as a result of God's control, David, as we wrap this up, he says there in verse number 9, "All men shall fear and shall declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider His doing." All men are going to fear God. Time number 3 that the word fear is used. Now, that's a great lesson right there. Number 1, man doesn't fear God. Number 2, man ought to fear God. Number 3, man will fear God. When you see the greatness of God, we will fear God. Let me understand this and understand this clearly. You can live your life without fear for God now, but one day you will. The question is, when are you going to fear God? You can fear God now while you can do something about it, or you can rebel against God and live without fear toward Him now and stand before Him in fear, in judgment, when it's too late, destined to spend eternity in hell. In Philippians 2, verses 9 through 11, Romans 14, 10 and 11, talks about every knee shall bow to Him. Every knee. The atheist is not going to remain an atheist. I'll tell you right now, there's no dead atheists.
There aren't. They know God exists now. Wherever they are, you know, living in torments, looking forward to what is there for eternity. Fear God now, so that you don't have to fear Him later. And he concludes in verse number 10, pointing out there, all will declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider His doing. And he goes on, the righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in Him. And all the upright of heart shall glory. And you find just several descriptions there of how the righteous are going to acknowledge God. Now he does point out there, all will wisely declare His work. And most of the commentators point to the fact that that's talking about His enemies as well. And another way of saying this is, eventually everybody's going to figure it out. You know, even the enemies of God, even those who think they have hidden from Him, one day they shall understand His operation. That's the way the pulpit commentary quotes it. They shall understand His operation. They'll know what's going on. But then, for many, it'll be too late. Let's just hope that where we're concerned, it is not too late. And thus we see another Psalm of David. And it's a Psalm that encourages us to stand up for what's right. And I encourage you that we will never, never, ever give up when it comes to serving God. It doesn't matter who your enemy is. You continue to trust in God. Do not lean on your own understanding. Lean on Him. And know that He is there to deliver you. And look at the example of David, whom the Lord delivered, even out of that which he was addressing in this psalm. Let's enjoy.